when we were on a train and couldn't be overheard, that until 1966, he studied Mesozoic structural geology, the geologic history of 65 to 225 million years ago. But with the Cultural Revolution, he found himself suddenly fascinated by earthquakes. It was the only safe path. Intellectuals in a variety of fields were protected through this program. Chinese historians and traditional literature scholars pored over a cache of historical records to create a catalog of earthquakes going back almost 4,000 years. It is a priceless scientific resource, the longest earthquake catalog in the world, drawn from the meticulous records kept by the mandarins, the bureaucrats of the Chinese Empire. Even though the researchers' work was sanctioned, they were sent to Tibet to complete it. A seismologist who was part of this team told me it was so that they could keep a low profile during the political turmoil. Zhou's protection could go only so far. She said her father had been a political prisoner, and she volunteered to join the team because she was afraid that her family history would make her a target. The Chinese scientists developing their prediction program faced the same fundamental problem we Westerners did, the sheer randomness of the earthquake process. There were simply no good theoretical models on which to base our predictions. But with no alternative but re-education, the scientists tried everything they could think of. Measurements of the earthquakes themselves were made using a network of seismographs, recorded on paper and read each day. Other instruments were developed and deployed to measure tilt in the ground level, telluric currents, which are electric currents in the ground, and changes to the chemistry and turbidity of groundwater. The scientists had to navigate the political hurricane swirling around them. To demonstrate that they weren't part of the stinking ninth, they instituted a program of data collection in what we would today call citizen science. Peasants on farms were asked to report anomalous phenomena, specifically changes to groundwater such as rising or falling wells, cloudiness, or unusual smells. They noted uncommon animal behavior. The scientists also instituted a program to educate people about earthquakes and their natural causes. The prevailing superstition that earthquakes were caused by problems of yin-yang balance in the government, they felt, was preventing China from addressing the problem. These programs coincided with a seismically active time. The Xingtai earthquakes of 1966 turned out to be the first of a series in northeastern China. The magnitude 6.3 Hejian earthquake in 1967 and the magnitude 7.4 Bohai earthquake in 1969 suggested a northeastward migration of earthquakes toward Manchuria, comprising the three provinces of China next to Korea. While most big earthquakes don't come in these sorts of clusters, other historic clusters, such as those seen in Turkey in the 1930s and 40s, have led to further damaging quakes, and the series made the scientists nervous. When, in 1971, the worst of the disruption of the Cultural Revolution had died down, the Chinese Earthquake Administration was formed. Three research institutes, in geology, geophysics, and biology, were founded in Beijing, and a seismology bureau for each province was established. The Earthquake Administration convened annual conferences, bringing the Beijing researchers and representatives from the provinces together to discuss where they anticipated areas of concern for the next year. Manchuria, especially Liaoning province, was always on the list, since the migration of big earthquakes was about the only concrete phenomenon they had to work with, and those three provinces were in its path. Instruments were installed in Liaoning, and in 1974, officials began monitoring ground tilt and electric currents. they found unusual signals. For instance, that summer they found what appeared to be strong tilting of the ground in the same direction at several sites. This was reported at the annual conference as cause for concern. The same signal showed up each successive summer. The scientists had neither the background nor the necessary control readings to rely on, so it was only later that they recognized their data was the result of water being pumped out of the ground for irrigation, rather than data that could contribute to anticipating any earthquake. Coming into the winter of 1974-75, the scientists in the Seismology Bureau were on edge. They were recording data they had no context for interpreting, aware of the migration of earthquakes, but with no basis for guessing which place would be next, and deathly afraid of the consequences of missing a big earthquake. In December, a swarm of small earthquakes started near the town of Bunxi in Liaoning, culminating in a magnitude 5.2 earthquake on December 22nd. That size earthquake was not too common, and it caused great concern. In the next 2 weeks, various predictions were issued by the local earthquake office for several different locations, but mostly around the area where the magnitude 5.2 had occurred. In some locations, people slept outside for a few days for fear of collapsing buildings. As the swarm of earthquakes died off, the alerts were withdrawn. Weekly reports continued to stream in, often registering strange animal behavior. But the peak of such activity on Saturday afternoons seemed to coincide with political meetings exhorting workers to report such anomalies, which were regularly held on Saturday mornings. On February 1, 1975, another swarm of small earthquakes began. When on the morning of February 4th, more than 500 earthquakes occurred in 12 hours near Haicheng, including a magnitude 4.7 that caused some damage, chaos ensued. Many opted to self-evacuate rather than await word from the government, which itself depended on the slow communication systems of 1975 rural China. The local observatory in Shipengyu that was recording these presumed foreshocks called their local town leaders and told them to expect a large main shock that night. The movie operator for the community decided to show movies outdoors throughout the night to convince people to leave their homes. An official in that county, which was named Yinko, had been extremely active in earthquake preparation, and he called for a formal evacuation. When the magnitude 7.3 Haicheng earthquake finally came on the evening of February 4th, lives were saved as a result of some of these exercises. The capital city of Yinko County had 72,000 residents, and although two-thirds of the buildings in the town collapsed, only 21 people died. The earthquake hit during the movie showings in Shipengyu, and all the people watching the movies were spared. A musical performance had been planned for a visiting military leader, but they canceled the performance and emptied the theater just minutes before the earthquake struck. The evacuation had been uneven, though, and nothing was done at the provincial level. In the neighboring county of Haicheng, without active evacuations, many more died. The final count of victims showed that for every 1,000 collapsed rooms, there were 30 casualties in Haicheng County, but only 11 in Yinko. Where there were lives saved, there was political hay waiting to be made. Chairman Mao's nephew, Mao Yuanxian, was a high-ranking member of the Liaoning Provincial Revolutionary Committee. His province, rather than the individual counties that initiated evacuations, was credited with the success. That even the natural world bent to the will of the party was too good a narrative to be ignored by the leftists, who were struggling to maintain power as the Cultural Revolution dragged on year after year, denying citizens school, safety, and stability. To a scared, resentful populace, the success of Chinese scientists in predicting the Haichung quake, when the rest of the world had thought prediction was impossible, burnished the reputation of the left. It was broadcast across the country. China had solved the problem of earthquake prediction. The scientists, of course, knew otherwise. They had been lucky, having observed so many foreshocks. There was no guarantee they could replicate their success. A year later, on July 27, 1976, a magnitude 7.8 earthquake struck Tangshan. A city of 1.5 million people, it was dedicated to coal. Its mines were the city's largest employer, and so critical to the nation's industrial interests that they operated in three shifts, 24 hours a day. Because no big faults had been recognized in the area, Tangshan was considered to have a low level of seismic risk. It had been built with essentially no attention to seismic resistance. It turned out that a fault ran right under the middle of the city. It was not that large a fault, with a relatively subtle surface expression, and the city had been built before any geologist had looked at the area. In the chaos of the 20th century, China hadn't had the time or focus to do a systematic investigation of the nation's seismic potential, and many faults lay unrecognized. And just as in Tokyo in 1923, the fault lying directly under the city meant the strongest shaking took place precisely where the greatest concentration of buildings was. The region was hopelessly unprepared. Almost all homes in Tangshan were either old brick houses or cheaply built multi-story apartments. To make matters much worse, the earthquake happened in the early morning when everyone but those working the night shift in the mines was asleep in their vulnerable homes. A friend of my family was from Tangshan originally, but was living in Hong Kong in 1976. Her extended family, including her mother and five brothers, remained in the city. They lived in some of the new apartment buildings, 10 stories tall. The day before the earthquake, her mother had fallen ill, so she went to an infirmary on the first floor of their building. Her illness made her restless. She was awake when the shaking began at 3:42 a.m. She ran to the door to escape, but it was jammed, so she scrambled out a window. From outside, she watched as all 10 stories collapsed, killing almost her entire family. Two elementary school-aged granddaughters woke as the earthquake caused their building to collapse, their seventh-floor apartment plummeting to the ground. The rubble trapped them in their bed, but they had been taught in school how to protect their heads and create airspace around them as debris settled. They suffered broken bones, but miraculously were dug out alive after 2 days. Every other member of their family who was in Tangshan that night was dead. It is impossible to tabulate the full extent of the damage caused by the earthquake that tore through Tangshan. In the first months, reports circulated that half of the city, or 750,000 people, had died. The Hebei Provincial Revolutionary Committee originally reported 655,000 dead. By the early 1980s, the official death toll had been revised downward to 242,000. The actual death toll will likely never be known. When I was in China in 1979, the city was still completely closed to foreigners, and those who had worked there told me that only two buildings in the entire city had withstood the earthquake. With nearly every building destroyed and countless lives lost, normal life simply failed to resume. For days, survivors struggled to dig out other survivors. Beijing knew there had been an earthquake. It was only 100 miles away, and Beijing had suffered damage itself. But the government was in turmoil. Mao Zedong was near death, and transportation and communication had been disrupted, so it took days to mobilize a response. Getting food and water to the victims proved difficult. Already living in bare subsistence, residents starved. One group of people who fared better than others were the miners working the night shift. Parts of the mines were flooded because the movement on the fault changed the flow patterns of groundwater. But no tunnels collapsed, and no miners died there. At first glance, this would seem surprising, but in fact, damage to tunnels in earthquakes is extremely rare. This is true for a couple of reasons. First, the amplitude of seismic shaking underground is only half of what it is at the surface. When a seismic wave hits the surface of the earth, it is reflected back downward, and that reflected wave also causes shaking. So at the surface, movement is double what you'd find within the earth. Second, tunnels generally have a round or oval cross-section, which is a very stable shape. Large aftershocks continued to rock the region. The city of Tianjin, home to 10 million people, was only 60 miles away and suffered one of the worst ones. The city government demanded that the earthquake administration send a seismologist to predict further aftershocks. Experts knew the task was scientifically and politically fraught. Anyone who could found a way not to be chosen. The seismologist left with the shortest straw was the most junior researcher at the Institute of Geophysics, the last one hired out of college before the Cultural Revolution closed universities. I'll call her Lao Zhang. She gave daily and weekly reports on the aftershocks and the expected rate of future aftershocks, monitoring their decay. Finally, almost a year after the main shock, she told the government that she didn't think there would be any more magnitude 6 or larger events. She was told that, "I think," was unacceptable. She had to say yes or no. She chose no. When she told me this story in 1979, she said she had lived the next 2 years in fear that she would be proved wrong. Fellow scientists at the Earthquake Administration made no bones about it. Tangshan hadn't been predicted. There had been no precursors. At the annual prediction meeting in early 1976, the Chinese scientists had argued over whether the occurrence of the Haicheng earthquake reduced or increased the risk of another big earthquake in the region. A migration pattern increases the risk of an earthquake until the pattern is over, but how do you know when that is? In the end, they included the Northeast on their list of possible sites for an earthquake that year, but did not pinpoint any particular place as most likely. A geologist with whom I worked, the one who left Mesozoic structure for earthquake studies, told me a story about Tangshan. He said that the day before the earthquake, the Hebei Provincial Seismological Bureau received a report that some wells near Tangshan were behaving anomalously. Some had turned artesian. The water level had increased to the point that water flowed out of them like a spring. This can occur naturally for a variety of reasons. But two scientists from the Bureau were going to be traveling past Tangshan anyway, so they were asked to stop in and investigate. They got into Tangshan late at night and went to sleep at a guest hostel, planning to look into it the next day. The hostel collapsed in the earthquake, and both scientists were killed. I asked him how often wells were reported turning artesian without an earthquake. He said it was quite common. It was in the 2 months after the earthquake that the political and scientific worlds really began to merge. Even more than in Japan, Chinese governance was rooted in the philosophy of Dong Zhongshu, the 2nd century BC pedant who had fused Confucian politics with yin-yang mysticism. For 2 millennia, aspiring scholars had had to pass exams on the classics, including the works of Dong Zhongshu, to enter government. The mandate of heaven justified the emperor's rule, and a natural disaster was a sign that the mandate had been withdrawn. Dong's admonition to the emperor to issue an edict of self-criticism after a natural disaster was still standard practice up until the end of the empire in 1911. The imperial order and the nation's scholarly bureaucrats may have been swept away by the communists, but a deeply ingrained mythology doesn't change overnight. Mao Zedong had explicitly cultivated the adulation of the public, and he filled the cultural niche once inhabited by the emperor. When the Tangshan earthquake hit, Chairman Mao was dying. Medical doctors had moved into the Forbidden City, and Mao had not been seen since April. Significantly, he did not go to Tangshan in the aftermath of the earthquake. Rumors of his illness were already swirling through the country. They merged with the prevailing superstitions about earthquakes. The classical texts were clear on the subject. An emperor's death, or impending death, would trigger an earthquake. In August 1976, a newspaper in Taiwan made the connection explicit, calling the Tangshan earthquake an omen of Mao's impending demise. Between the public misgivings about earthquake prediction and the possibility that one earthquake wasn't enough to restore the yin-yang balance, earthquake panic swept the country. Half of the provincial seismology bureaus issued predictions, and as was seen before Haicheng, even more people decided on their own to stay out of buildings. My colleague said that in August 1976, as many as 500 million people may have been sleeping outside. A magnitude 7.2 occurred on August 16th in the mountains of Sichuan province, when most of the almost 100 million residents of China's largest province were already living outside. For the tiny fraction of those 100 million who lived in the epicentral area, this practice may have saved lives. But the earthquake further stoked fear and uncertainty. Mao Zedong died on September 9th, setting off a power struggle. Many books have been written parsing the dynamics in the aftermath of his passing between the leftists who had carried out the Cultural Revolution, led by Mao's wife, Jiang Qing, and the more moderate members of the party. A month after Mao's death, a coup by the moderates arrested Jiang Qing and 3 others, labeled the Gang of Four. They moved quickly and effectively, detaining them without bloodshed, despite strong support for the leftists in many provinces and major cities. The response to the Tangshan earthquake could well have been a factor in the quick dispatching of the leftists. Tangshan fit with several of Dong Zhongshu's other warnings. In addition to a dying emperor, the 2 other main causes of excess yin were said to be ministers having usurped the power of the emperor and the presence of women in government. Both charges were laid against the Gang of Four. In the indictments, the leftists were accused of using Mao's name and prestige to accomplish their own ends. And Jiang Qing's indictment emphasized her womanly wiles, the flagrant sexuality of her relationship with Mao. This, of course, played into deep-seated cultural prejudices about women, ones beyond any relationship with natural disasters. But it didn't hurt, in their prosecution, to have such a manifest example of the consequences of a yin imbalance. No one ever officially blamed the Gang of Four for causing the Tangshan earthquake. The Communist Party was working hard to eliminate these types of superstitions. But the party used phrases from Dong Zhengshu's treatise in the indictment to subtly make the tie back to the earthquake. The undercurrent in public thought is evident. Big earthquakes usually cause rumors of more earthquakes to come in the area affected by the event, as they should given the prevalence of aftershocks. However, the mass self-evacuation of 500 million people, as was seen in China in 1976, was unprecedented. Their actions across the country and so far from Tangshan were driven by traditional superstition. When I was in Beijing in 1979, the Gang of Four was in jail but not yet on trial. I was a novelty, one of only 35 Americans in Beijing and the first scientist. I wasn't completely free to talk with the Chinese, but there were many situations, in the residence compound, restaurants, taxis, where my job as a seismologist was discussed. I was astonished at the widespread belief in the government's ability to predict earthquakes. One car driver proudly told me that the Chinese didn't have to worry about earthquakes anymore because the party would give the warning. What about Tangshan, then, I asked. He, like the majority of non-scientists I spoke to, assured me that Tangshan had been predicted, but that the Gang of Four wouldn't let the seismologists share it. He told me that they didn't want anyone talking about an earthquake that they had caused by taking over the government, by usurping Mao's power. I came home from China with a changed view of earthquake prediction. I completed a study of the physics of the Haicheng 4 shocks, showing that they had actually delayed the main shock. That raised our hopes that we could find a discriminant for 4 shocks, something that made them look different from other earthquakes, but we never did. I also came to understand that earthquake prediction was, at its heart, not a scientific problem, or at least not just a scientific problem. When I discuss the inherent randomness of the timing of disasters, there is one obvious exception, the ability of one earthquake to trigger another. Amaury first quantified it over 100 years ago. But it turns out the Earth doesn't have its own hard definition of what an aftershock should be. Overwhelmingly, aftershocks are smaller than main shocks. But at the outer extremes of the probability distribution, occurring 5% of the time, are aftershocks that are bigger. Similarly, while most happen close in time and space to the main shock, we sometimes see longer clusters that include many large earthquakes, like those we saw in northeast China. When I went to Beijing, these ideas were still developing. Chinese scientists didn't know any more about prediction than we did. But unlike us, they lived in a political climate that forced them to act on their guesses, something we American scientists could never do. In rural China, where bad construction increased the benefit of anticipating an earthquake, and where a farming economy decreased the costs of a false alarm, guessing could be worthwhile. In America, where many more people die in traffic accidents than in earthquakes, the economic costs of evacuation could have been devastating, and the public perception, distilled in the free press, presented a huge political downside to false alarms. The same information is less actionable. I spent the next decade of my career trying to quantify the probabilities that one earthquake would trigger another. I thought that if we did our part to collect and interpret seismologic information and then translated it into probabilities, we could hand it over to policymakers and emergency managers who would synthesize it with social, political, and cultural considerations and decide what course of action needed to be taken. It was naive of me, I realize now, to think that anyone can make decisions on the basis of probabilities alone. It was a lesson that I put to use much more effectively 25 years later. Chapter 8, Disasters Without Borders. The Indian Ocean, 2004. Every person is a new door, opening up into other worlds. John Guare, 6 Degrees of Separation. One of the most important tenets of research science is the acknowledgement that the easiest person to fool is yourself. All human beings, including scientists, are inclined to confirmation biases. We are less critical of information that supports our pre-existing beliefs and more critical of data that confounds them. The scientific process, especially peer review, was developed to help researchers recognize when we are not seeing the data clearly. In peer review, we take our research, our intellectual offspring, the prized result of our hard work, and put it in the hands of a colleague, or even a competitor, and ask him or her to tear it apart, to find the flaws, and tell us what we did wrong. It can be so emotionally difficult that many new PhDs will decide they'd rather pursue a career that doesn't involve research. This is an unfortunate downside of a process that is critical to finding out what is undeniably true. One consequence of having our work regularly torn to shreds is that scientists tend to be very careful to say just what we mean. We never present a result before laying out all the background and describing the full experiment. We avoid using vague qualifiers. If I were to say, this is a big earthquake, a colleague would be ready to tell me that in fact, it is not as big as another earthquake, or that it is big only if you neglect site amplification, or don't take into account the paleoseismic record, or... We can say big only after defining precisely what big means. With each disaster, scientists are asked, was this the big one? Those implied capital letters always seem to be part of the question. To answer, to analyze and compare disasters, we need an approach that lets us quantify the variations between them. So in each field, scientists have come up with a scheme for classifying the relative size of an event, each based on some measurable, indisputable quantity. Maximum wind speed is used to classify hurricanes, the Saffir-Simpson scale, and tornadoes, the Fujita. Volcanoes have a volcanic explosivity index, VEI, defined by how much material they've thrown off, to what height, and for what duration. It's a 0 to 8 scale. Vesuvius in AD 79 was a 5. Laki in 1783 was a 6. Floods are the only natural hazard classified by their probability of occurrence. A 100-year flood has a 1 in 100 chance of happening in a given year. For earthquakes, seismologists created magnitude, representing the total energy released in an event. Each scale represents a physical measurement, something that can be defended to colleagues, reduced to a simple number that seems easier to explain to the public. But none of them reflect the damage experienced by individuals. Destruction is difficult to quantify. Terror is impossible to measure. Scientists are much more comfortable living in the defined, physical, quantifiable world. And these physical measurements are not wrong. They do what they are supposed to do, define what happened physically in the world. The problem is that when someone asks, "Was this the big one?" there is a disconnect between the language used by the person asking in human terms and the scientist answering, in terms of physical effect. Sometimes, however, the physical and the human are in sync, the big one is truly the big one. The magnitude 9.1 earthquake and tsunami that hit the west coast of Sumatra, Indonesia, on December 26, 2004, is just such an event. The physical scale of it was unprecedented. The length of the fault that moved in that earthquake was over 900 miles, the longest earthquake rupture ever seen. The earthquake that leveled San Francisco in 1906 was on a fault 275 miles long. It took fully 9 minutes for the rupture front to move from one end to the other. The earthquake took place in a subduction zone called the Sunda Arc. In purely physical terms, subduction zones give us the world's biggest earthquakes. We've seen how the size of an earthquake is dependent on the distance of the slip and the length of the fault on which the earthquake occurs. Yet there's a bit more complexity to it. Plates can be as much as 50 miles thick. The deepest parts are so hot that friction can't hold them in place. The rock becomes ductile, able to deform itself, pulling like taffy instead of breaking. It's at shallower depths, the first 10 to 15 miles, that friction holds the edges of plates immobile. Here, the rock bends, storing elastic energy. When friction is overcome and one side slides suddenly past the other, we observe an earthquake. Its magnitude, then, is primarily determined by three factors: the distance of the slip, the length of the fault, and the depth at which friction is held. The San Francisco earthquake of 1906 involved a comparatively small depth of 8 miles. But the fault it was on was almost 300 miles, and the slip was significant enough that, taken together, they created a magnitude 7.8 earthquake. We've also seen earthquakes in subduction zones in which one plate is pressed beneath another, like a truck pushing up and over a small car in a rear-end collision. These plates generally meet at a shallow dip, just 5 to 20 degrees. The rocks being pushed under are colder because they have only recently been close to the surface. Cold temperature means more opportunities for friction. This results in a much wider fault. To see what this all means, imagine two faults, each 200 miles long, one vertical and one subhorizontal. The vertical fault has earthquakes in just its top 10 miles. So the area of the fault could be said to be 2,000 square miles. A subhorizontal fault in a subduction zone can have earthquakes in its top 20 miles because the rock being pressed down is still relatively cold and not yet ductile. But with a 10-degree dip, there are 115 miles of fault that lie in that 20-mile band. The area of that 200-mile-long fault is now 23,000 square miles. The same length of fault has an area more than 10 times greater. Add to this the fact that subduction earthquakes tend to have greater slip, and the result is a much bigger earthquake. Only the biggest subduction zone earthquakes can produce ocean-spanning tsunamis. A magnitude 8.0 can produce a tsunami that is devastating locally, but it will not have displaced enough water to create waves that can traverse ocean basins. If, however, you hear that there has been an earthquake with a magnitude of about 8.5 or larger, you can be pretty sure that it is on a subduction zone and that a tsunami will immediately follow. A tsunami is a wave with multiple peaks and troughs. Instead of thinking of it as a very big ocean wave, you need to think of it more like the ripples that encircle a rock that you drop into a pool of water. A series of up and down movements travel out from a disturbance of the ocean floor. How many peaks and troughs, their relative sizes, and how far apart they are all depend on the shape of the seafloor, not to mention the shape of the coastline where the wave hits. If a trough arrives first, then the first sign of an incoming tsunami is not rising, but receding seawater. If a tsunami wave is 20 feet high, then everything that is less than 20 feet above sea level goes underwater. If there is a 30-foot cliff at the ocean's edge, the tsunami will not reach land. If the sea level is already 2 feet higher than average, because it's high tide, the tsunami wave will be 2 feet higher, submerging anything below 22 feet of elevation. The damage is usually done not by flooding, but by the currents. The wave will first travel across the ocean at the speed of a jet plane. But as the seafloor shallows, it will slow to the speed of a car. Still, a huge mass of water moving at 20 miles per hour has an almost incomprehensible amount of energy. Anything not very securely anchored in place will be carried away. Cars and people are easily swept off. Weak buildings can be pushed over. Strong buildings can have all the walls stripped off them, leaving just the frame. I've seen pictures of an apartment in a strong building where the only item left was the refrigerator. It was too heavy to be carried away, left in its place, draped in seaweed. The Sumatran earthquake had the third largest magnitude ever recorded. It represented the longest fault we have ever seen slip. It displaced the third largest volume of water ever recorded and produced by far the biggest wave we have ever seen in the Indian Ocean. The energy released in the event was 1,000 times larger than that of the largest hydrogen bomb ever detonated. Its human impact was no less momentous. The 2004 magnitude 9.1 earthquake itself, for all its movement, did not affect as many people as its size might suggest. The fault largely ran under the ocean and sparsely inhabited islands. The earthquake began just before 8 a.m. the day after Christmas. Aceh Province, at the north end of the island of Sumatra, was at the southern end of the earthquake rupture, and its proximity to the fault meant it suffered some of the worst effects. Many buildings in the province of Aceh and its capital, Banda Aceh, were badly damaged from the shaking. Tsunami waves arrived soon after the main shock ended, even as aftershocks continued. Along the western coast of Aceh, wave height was 50 to 100 feet. The number of dead is uncertain because many people were washed out to sea, their bodies never recovered. We know that the total number of dead or missing in Indonesia was more than 200,000, 3 times as many as in any other country, and most were from Aceh province. The first floors of most buildings in Banda Aceh, a city with almost 300,000 residents, were flooded, and 10% of the population perished. Leipung, a town of 10,000 also on the west coast of Aceh, was completely obliterated. Only a few hundred survived. The small islands north and west of Aceh sit on the subduction zone, and so were both shaken strongly in the earthquake and hit quickly by the tsunami. Due to the contours of the seafloor and the coastline geometry, some islands suffered much larger waves than others. The northernmost of the islands saw tsunami heights of only 5 to 10 feet, while Ketchal Island in the Nicobar Island group was hit with a 35-foot tsunami that killed 90% of its population. The indigenous tribes on Ketchal lost essentially all their tribal leadership, their way of life, and their culture. On another island, Simala, The community's memory of a tsunami in 1907 spurred them to head to higher ground as soon as the earthquake was over, and very few died. The next country hit after Indonesia was Sri Lanka, 1,000 miles west of the fault. Earthquakes produce waves of many frequencies, and just as with sound, the lower-pitched waves travel farther than the higher-pitched ones. In the same way that, when hearing music from far away, you might hear the lower frequencies of the drum beat, but not the higher frequencies of the melody. Consequently, although in a nearby earthquake you will feel a high-frequency jerky motion, distant earthquakes are often experienced as a slow rolling, which some reported feeling in Sri Lanka. The tsunami wave took about 90 minutes to traverse the Bay of Bengal. It wrapped around this island country, hitting all the coastlines at heights from 13 to 40 feet. Because many of the towns were near the coast, their wooden buildings were easily carried away, and more than 40,000 people died. Tsunamis produce their strongest waves directly perpendicular to a fault. Since the fault in the Sumatra earthquake ran approximately north-south, its impact was felt gravely to the west in Sri Lanka, but also in Thailand to the east. The west coast of Thailand is a popular beach destination for tourists from across the world, and its hotels were full for the Christmas holidays. When the waves arrived 2 hours after the earthquake, they were second in height only to those hitting Indonesia, with some reaching 64 feet. The tsunami continued its inexorable progression across the Indian Ocean, taking lives in India, Malaysia, the Maldives, and Myanmar. It reached the east coast of Africa, killing people in Yemen, Seychelles, South Africa, and Kenya. The waves spilled out of the Indian Ocean into both the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans, their continued movement recorded for the next few days on monitoring instruments of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. In total, it struck 13 countries, causing damage to infrastructure and buildings in 5 more. 47 others lost citizens who were traveling abroad, many of them vacationers in Thailand. In this respect, it was not only a massive physical event with a devastating human toll. The Sumatran tsunami was the world's first truly global disaster. In 1977, Kerry C. got his Ph.D. in geology from Stanford University, with research so innovative that he was immediately offered a professorship at Caltech. Eventually, his work led to the creation of a whole new field of research called paleoseismology. Not bad for a 26-year-old. Up until that point, geologists had studied faults by examining the features and layers of rock that were offset in earthquakes, and by assessing how the surface of the earth had been changed as a result. That's called geomorphology. Kerry's innovation was to recognize that there was much more information available right at the fault surface if we could somehow get in and see it. So he came up with the idea of digging a trench across a fault and mapping out, inch by inch, the features that had been moved by it. He used a site in a marsh where new ground is rapidly created as the dirt settles in stagnant water. These layers can be dated by measuring the carbon-14 in the organic material. When the San Andreas moves in an earthquake, it cuts through all the layers. But after the earthquake, new layers will be laid down on top. By mapping out the layers that were cut or not cut, Kerry could create a history of earthquakes on a fault that had moved just once in our recorded history. From that beginning, Kerry and his students, and later their students, continued to develop the field digging into faults across California and beyond. This work allowed us to know that on average, every 100 to 200 years, all of the San Andreas moves in a big earthquake, information that would have been impossible to glean from the historic record alone. Subduction zones, however, with their faults offshore, pose a unique problem, their pasts hidden. We could tell from the fast motion of the Indian Ocean plate that earthquakes in the Sunda Arc had to have been pretty common, but our written history wasn't even 100 years old. The 1907 earthquake was well enough remembered by the elders of Simala to spare that tribe, but it formed the extent of their and our historic record. That was until Carey came up with another idea. Perite corals grow along the Sunda Arc, and they thrive in the sunshine to a degree. They grow, adding rings to themselves annually, until they've reached just below the waterline and no farther. After that, their growth runs sideways. If the ground were to move up and push them above the surface, the exposed part of them would die. And if the ground sank, they would resume their vertical growth until they again reached the water surface. Along a subduction zone, plate motion holds one slab down, allowing the corals above it to grow to full height. But when the slip of an earthquake happens, a plate snaps up, pushing the coral above sea level and killing the parts that have been exposed. Could this phenomenon be used in some way to draw a seismic history from subduction faults? In early 2004, Carey and one of his students, Danny Natawijaya, published a major paper documenting great earthquakes on the Sunda Arc that had occurred in 1797 and 1833. This meant that instead of knowing about one earthquake in 1907, we now know that there have been three earthquakes in the last 250 years. This makes it easier for us to stipulate that earthquakes happen pretty often in that location, about once per century, give or take. And that means that another was in our future, most likely in the lifetime of many people alive now. Danny was Indonesian, and that summer he was heading back to Indonesia to finish the last round of fieldwork for his PhD. All too aware of the risk posed by tsunamis, and knowing how unprepared his country was, Danny and Carey created posters explaining what a tsunami was and how moving away from the coast after a big earthquake could save lives. The posters, written in English for tourists, Indonesian, and the regional language, Mentawai, were distributed and posted in their field area in the summer of 2004, several months before the Sumatran earthquake. It is difficult to quantify harm that didn't happen, but there are undoubtedly those who survived the tsunami because of Danny and Carey's efforts. Not many scientists get to see the results of their work so clearly. It begs a bigger question, though. Why were so many lost when a warning could easily have saved them? I received an email 15 minutes after the 2004 event began, explaining that a magnitude 8.8 estimated earthquake had occurred off the north end of Sumatra. I get an email like this for every magnitude 5 or greater earthquake in the world, and so can anyone else who wants to. The USGS Earthquake Program website offers such a service. So I knew almost immediately that a deadly tsunami was likely striking the Indian Ocean. I sat in front of my Christmas tree in California, knowing a catastrophe was unfolding, but powerless to do anything about it. Getting wide-scale warnings to people at risk is possible, but it requires infrastructure. You need the instruments to record an event, people to man a warning center, and the means to convey an alert to those at risk, as well as their governments. In 1946, an earthquake in Alaska created a tsunami that killed 150 people in Hawaii, leading the U.S. government to create the Pacific Tsunami Warning Center, PTWC, in Hawaii in 1949. After the deadly 1960 Chilean earthquake led to a tsunami that killed dozens in Hawaii and hundreds more in Japan, the Warning Center expanded into an international operation, providing alerts for the entire Pacific Basin. When the 2004 Sumatran earthquake hit, the PTWC issued a statement that there was no tsunami risk to the Pacific Basin. In itself, true. But it was made in line with the limitations of the PTWC, which permitted warnings only for the western side of the Pacific Ocean. The last time an earthquake that large had registered was 40 years earlier, with the 1964 Alaskan earthquake. But the technology available at that time could not discriminate the true size of our largest earthquakes. It was only with the advent of digital recording and processing in the 1980s and 90s that we could even see the extra energy contained within the Earth's biggest earthquakes. The PTWC personnel still relied on older technology, so they initially understated the size of the event. By an hour later, they'd realized the earthquake was bigger than they had anticipated, but there were no established channels for reaching the governments in the affected countries. Even when they did get through, those countries didn't have mechanisms for conveying warnings to people on the coasts. It is hard for scientists to contemplate how many lives might have been spared if our data had been better communicated. Fortunately, steps have since been taken. We saw with the California floods of the 1860s how we tend to minimize threats that have faded from our collective memory. The flip side of that tendency is to respond aggressively to those perils that are still fresh in our minds. The enormity of the losses suffered in Sumatra, combined with the knowledge that a technological solution could have prevented deaths, has led to action. Less than 2 weeks after the tsunami, a proposal was put together to implement a warning system for the Indian Ocean and to address some of the antiquated technology. A system is now in place, coordinated by the United Nations, using data systems from Australia, Indonesia, and India. The Pacific Ocean warning systems have started using more modern techniques for estimating size, leaving the world less vulnerable to future disasters. Most of us have heard of the notion of 6 degrees of separation, the theory that any person on the planet is connected to any other person on the planet through a chain of acquaintances with no more than 5 intermediaries. I would guess that the chain between anyone in the world and a victim of the Sumatran tsunami rarely exceeds 3. For example, my brother had a colleague at work who never returned from his Christmas holiday in Thailand. Los Angeles has a large Sri Lankan community. I am sure one of the Sri Lankans I know someone who was killed. 57 different countries lost citizens, almost 1/3 of the world's countries. Some countries lost more citizens in the tsunami than from events at home. The Sumatran tsunami killed more Swedes than any other natural disaster in their history, more than any single event in their history, since a battle in 1709. Globalization and the convenience of air travel have changed the world in fundamental ways. For the first time, many, if not most people throughout the world, shared in the loss from this one natural disaster. Advances in telecommunications also fundamentally deepened the impact of this disaster. Pictures of the devastation traveled around the world faster than the tsunami itself. On our TVs and computers, we saw images of flattened houses, water surges, massive ships tossed to shore as if they were toy boats.